Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013, Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting. The first item on our agenda is requests from visitors and speakers from the floor. Is there anybody who is here to speak on a matter that is not already on our printed agenda? Okay. Seeing none. Is there anybody signed up there?
Not for something not on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Eifer. Okay. So that brings us to, I believe, item C. No, we have a resolution. Excuse me.
Can I speak to this one resolution?
Yes, ma'am. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'll speak to the Clean Water Management Trust Fund one. And so what we have, we actually have two, but one is just a copy of one to remind us that we got monies to purchase the Adams track from years ago, okay? But the one that's current that we're voting on tonight, Matt just gave it to us. It has a border all the way around it. And so, Mark, what I wanted to tell you is near the end, there's a paragraph that says Clean Water Management Trust Fund has provided grants. I'd like to fill in there to Carrboro for our Adams tract and for our Bullen Creek restoration project, particularly Baldwin Park. As particular type projects that we use the Clean Water Management Trust Fund monies for.
So. Can we? I don't recall whether that grant was to the town of Carrboro or to the town of Carrboro and Orange County, maybe jointly.
It was partnered.
It was a partnership. Mm-hmm. Anyway, can we just make sure, whichever it is, that's what we're resolving. If we could just clarify that and make sure that the resolution reads correctly on that point. I've had over the years plenty to criticize about my compatriots up in Hillsborough, but credit where it is due. Orange County did a lot to help us with that purchase. So,
just for those that don't know the particular what we're talking about, this is a resolution to support 2013-2015 funding for the Clean Water Management Trust Fund. Because the funding for this trust fund, it was reduced. It's been reduced by 78% since 2010, and we're unsure as to what their financial picture will be in the upcoming year. And so we're urging that what they have at least be sustained, if not establishment back to previous monies.
All right. I'll take that as a motion.
Yeah, so I can move the resolution.
Second for the resolution. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed, matter passed unanimously. And there was a second resolution?
Yeah, and it's already at your desk, but there's an added whereas to this that speaks to the fact that we've already had a meeting with Duke Energy and requested LED lights. And so I wanted to add a second therefore to this current one because it's important that we ramp it up a little more. And so we happen to have a call with the League of Municipalities today, and it looks like they will be seeking representation through a law firm, and that contingent on how much electricity municipalities use, then the idea is that we would pitch in to help hire that law firm. So I'd like to add that... Well, for one, we haven't really made that decision, but it may cost some money. So maybe help me as we tweak this language. But I'd like to add, be it further resolved that the town of Carrboro requests the League of Municipalities represent municipalities that are in the Duke Energy Carolina territories in the next rate hike case, including the pursuit of the Progress Energy customer-owned LED rate. So I don't know if that's an issue for y'all because we haven't really made that decision of...
So you're saying the language you're proposing is that we ask the League of Municipalities to represent all of the municipalities,
right.
who to spend some money on representing all the municipalities.
Yes.
who are great
representation they one of their asks be this pursuit of this Progress Energy LED rate.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that makes sense to me. Very good. All right. So this resolution with that amendment has been moved. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Thank you.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Hunter passes unanimously. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Sammy and Lydia for being on top of both of these issues. All right, I believe that brings us to item C, our consent agenda, Mr. Manager.
Mr. Mayor, members of the board, you have three items on the consent agenda. Item number one is the approval of the minutes from January 15th. The second item is the report on the impact of downtown traffic, levels of service for the closing of Weaver Street for an event. And item three is a funding amendment for the Homestead Chapel Hill High School multi-use path project and Morgan Creek Greenway. Mr. Mayor.
I had a question about item three.
And I have a question about item two.
All right. So is there a motion for the dissent agenda? Is there a motion for item one?
Moved.
All right. Moved and seconded. It's seconded somewhere?
Second.
I'll second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Mayor passing unanimously. Item two, the level of service on Weaver Street.
I had a question about just the wording. If you look at attachment A, it says, whereas Open Streets Days and the Cyclovias have been held around the U.S. and around the world to encourage active transportation by temporarily allowing cyclists and pedestrians exclusive enjoyment of urban streets and parkways. We don't have parkways. Do we need to
maybe take out those two words?
Yeah. Or at least modify it for us.
So. All right.
Sure.
So I'll take that as a motion for attachment A with the words and parkways to leave.
Can we say greenways? Because we do have greenways.
Well, but you don't close down
well, we don't
the greenways.
Close, space. Right.
The idea is that, you know, the more bike and walking you use, you'll use those facilities too, in that it's a.
I know, but the goal for this is open streets, and I wouldn't want to align streets and greenways.
Look at the clause for a second, Sammy.
Okay, because they're already exclusive.
Because
okay,
they're already exclusively
so striking parkways.
And parkways, right. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So that's
right.
A motion, Jackie?
Before we pass that, even though this is part of the consent agenda and we aren't spending a great deal of time on it, I'd like to thank staff for the great deal of time that they put into writing it. It's obviously a very well-researched and put-together agenda item, much longer than most things that we have on the agenda. On the consent agenda. So thank you for the thought and effort that went into that. It was not unnoticed.
A clear sign that our staff gets the town that they work for.
And, mm-hmm. and I want to add on to that. Thank you to the community that has been so involved in helping develop this Open Streets effort, mm-hmm. too, because I know there are a lot of groups that are involved and even local businesses. So thanks to all for this being a coordinated and hopefully a very successful effort.
It's going to be very cool.
All right, so Mark, I'll take that as a second. Yes,
well,
ma'am.
We can vote on this, and then I just want to raise a question.
Why don't you raise your question?
Okay, well, I just wanted to ask if in doing this, this is a transportation report, and it doesn't give us, as much information, or it doesn't give any information regarding the businesses and the business perspective. And I noticed that the language that was used is that most businesses were comfortable. So that kind of piqued my curiosity as to what kind of businesses might have concerns. So I just wanted to ask if Annette would just look into that and just follow up with us.
Or do you know?
Do you know now?
Come up to the podium.
Oh, that would be great.
If you know,
thanks.
If you I have a sense of that right now. Just go ahead and tell us.
Already, as part of the coordination that Sammy is, Alderman Slade is talking about, here we are over here, we have been talking to businesses and know what businesses are closed and what businesses will be impacted. And largely, everyone is fine. The Country Junction is probably the only one that's a little problematic because of her clientele that are in that time frame, but we have talked with her. She is okay with it. although it may impact what happens that morning, I think there's opportunity to grow her business, people who will see it and you know, experience it in a way that they haven't before because of being on the street. So, of course, there'll be a public hearing on this to be set, but we have talked to the businesses and feel real comfortable that everybody knows what's going on, prepared, alternate parking's being planned, all those things are sort of being addressed. So,
and the proposed date for this is
March 18th?
April 13th.
All right. So everybody come to the, assuming that it's approved at the public hearing, everybody come on April 13th. Stop by the Country Junction, get yourself a chicken biscuit.
That's right.
Or they probably have some kind of vegetarian option, I'm guessing.
Probably not.
Not vegan.
Probably not vegan, but they've got some kind of...
Maybe not vegan. Yeah, there's vegetables. Yeah. Not quite vegan.
Sounds a biscuit with lettuce on it.
lettuce biscuit.
There you go.
All right. Okay. If y'all, those of you who are listening at home, if there are some of y'all who don't know about Country Junction, well, then... this challenge. Find out.
And do it by bike.
And do it by bike or public transportation or walk. All right, very good. They're on Weaver Street between Weaver Street Market and Town Hall. All right.
So I'll move that item now.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed. Matter passes unanimously.
Okay, so the item I had a question about, it's kind of reallocating some of our money, well, all of our money that right now is targeted toward Rose Creek Greenway to go toward the Homestead Chapel Hill multi-use path and then the Morgan Creek Greenway. My question is just this. I know Jones Creek Greenway, I know we've run into some hitches in trying to figure out exactly where that's going to go. I think that's the issue. And I think I just wanted to confirm that's the case, that's the reason. And see with either Trish or Jeff or whoever, what does this mean in terms of that project? Is it still going to be next, or is it looking like it's coming to some kind of resolution or coming to us sometime soon? Or hopefully it's not going to just go away for a while.
Jeff says he's willing to have Trish be on the spot.
For the time being, we won't have that one in the list for STPDA funding. That would be the effect of the decision. We have not yet done the design for that project, and our preliminary estimate of the cost of it does exceed the amount we have for the STPDA funding. So, and we don't have the match identified for that. Mm-hmm. When we've done the prioritization of the funding from the bond, dollars for sidewalks and greenway match. It hasn't come up to the point where we've had some funds to put over there, essentially. So.
Is it more of a funding issue then, or more of a also trying to figure it out?
Well, it's a timing issue, too, in terms of there is a figuring out piece. Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes. And, we do have one other project out there, which is the CMAC. There's CMAC funding available for the piece of the Jones Creek Greenway right below Twin Creeks between what has been defined as this project in the past. Mm-hmm. And that funding, I think, is available in 2015. That's the congestion mitigation funding.
So if I can jump in for just a second, to get down to the real nitty-gritty of this. So what the Jones Creek Greenway or connection or whatever it's called is really all about is trying to complete that connection build the next section of that connection that would one day go from Homestead Road north all the way to Eubanks Road.
Well, it is a piece of that.
Part of that. It's one of what two remaining major gaps to complete that.
Yeah, essentially, and this particular project that's defined within the agenda item has STPDA funding identified for it is part of the Jones Creek piece, and so that takes you from Bowling Creek and Lake Hogan Farms, right near Turtleback Crossing, up to the to essentially the boundary of, well, that this piece, it would just take you up to the southern boundary of the Ballantyne property. Mm-hmm. So, and the other piece
which
that
is,
hasn't...
Which is, in other words, nearly, almost connecting, or, you know, a short distance
yes.
away from connecting all the way to the existing path that leads up to the school.
Yes, that's right. And that's mm-hmm. the project. I mean, that other segment of it is the piece that has funding identified in 2015. And then we don't yet have, a project defined for the piece within the Carolina Commons property, mm-hmm. the UNC property, the other Horace Williams piece, which is just north of Winmore. So that's another kind of a gap. But that's on Bolin Creek, and this is the piece on Jones Creek.
Yeah, just as to this piece, I understand. Thanks, Trish, for that explanation. And I know it's been a combination of a few things, but just speaking for, lots and lots of folks that live at Lake Hogan Farms and in my neighborhood and in others, we go back there on our bikes a lot and get all muddy and everything. It'd be nice to have it'll be nice once that connection's just a little bit closer. I mean, it's so nice right now. It goes from Morris Grove toward, Lake Hogan Farms. For quite a piece, and then just stops. And right. from there, it's a dirt path that's very well worn. So as we look at this in the future, kind of working to kind of bring it in a little closer to eventually connect up is, it's in our plan. So.
Okay.
Keep our eyes on it.
We're keeping our eyes on the prize, she says. All right, very
thanks,
good.
Sure.
All right. All those, is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Thanks very much. That brings us to an item we did not get to last week. Sorry, George. Presentation of the capital improvements plan for the town of Carrboro. Mr. Manager.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, we postponed a couple of times, but we're ready to go. Arch is all set and ready. Complete with his UNC tie and vest.
Yeah, he is dressed.
They need some.
Wearing the right colors, too.
Don't mind.
Don't mind.
From you.
Arch, in fairness, I'm also sorry for you. This is yes. taking a little while to get to, but.
Well, we're very patient around here.
I've noticed that about you.
I'm learning a lot from you, Mr. Mayor. Mayor and board members, this evening in presenting the recommended capital improvements program through fiscal year 2018-19. There are four things I'd like to do this evening. One, highlight the types of projects that's included in the CIP, outline the potential revenue sources, show the impact on the town's debt ratios, as well as show the impact on the operating budget. The department heads are here that they can address more in specifics if you are interested in a particular project. The objectives in doing the capital improvement program, are the same as they were last year. One of the things to keep in mind is that this is a planning process where we try to identify our future capital needs and also identify how we might pay for them. At the same time, we want to be cognizant of the town's financial health, and we want to always make sure that the town's financial health is in good order. The way we fund projects in the CIP is either through the annual operating budget appropriation or through project ordinances adopted by the board during the year. Before we talk about the specific projects, it's always nice to take a time out and look at what you have accomplished, because these are big ticket items and they're multi-years, and sometimes you forget about the project. One of the things we'd like to highlight is that we did complete reconstruction of Weaver Street last spring. That was a $1.4 million project. Sidewalks, we have completed 20 sidewalks covering roughly 4 miles. We have 5 sidewalk projects that are underway or nearing construction. Pine Street's under construction and it's almost complete. We're expecting to start construction this summer on Davy Road and the Smith Level Road. And starting in 2013-14, we hope to have Rogers Road and Shelton Street. Greenway Trails, Wilson Park multi-use path is under construction. The engineering is underway for Bowling Creek Phase 1B and Morgan Creek Greenway. This year we're looking at a proposed CIP of $40.3 million. We divided these projects into these 5 categories. Current projects representing 27%. Mandated stormwater projects. With the new Jordan Lake rules, we are required to do certain things, and we have, you know, factored those into the capital improvement program, and we will begin, if I remember correctly, next year or the following year, having to begin to deliver some of those projects. Vehicles and equipment, we're looking at $6.8 million. Technology, $207,000. New projects represent the majority of the $40 million at $21.4 million. Last year, we had a total CIP of about $39.6 million, roughly $700,000 less than we have this year. Under the current projects, we have 6 projects. Street resurfacing. Last year, we did not. Normally, under street resurfacing, we set aside a certain amount each year and transfer that over. And every 2 years, we resurface the streets. Last year, we did not make that transfer. But in this year's budget, we are planning to make that transfer. The Recreation and Parks Facilities Maintenance Fund is a fund that is patterned after the street resurfacing program. We identified the needs. Unfortunately, we have not made a specific set aside for the Recreation Parks Facilities Maintenance Fund. We have normally funded those each year during the budget process, or we have designated fund balance for specific projects. The other current projects, Bowling Creek Greenway, Wilson Park, multi-use path, Morgan Creek, multi-use path, and again, the sidewalks. In terms of vehicles, there's a much more specific detail list in the CIP on the vehicles that will be replaced. But this is just a summary by year of the dollar amount that is in the CIP that's needed for vehicles and equipment over the next 6 years. If you'll notice that in the current year, we're only looking at around $400,000, and next fiscal year, and the following fiscal year, it jumps up significantly. One of the challenges in vehicles and equipment for us is to go back and take a look and make sure that we are getting as much utilization out of all of our vehicles, you know, as we can before we replace them. Each year, when we do the budget development process, we revisit the list of vehicles that have been prioritized.
Arch, can I ask a question on the vehicles so we don't get so far away? the jump in 2013, 2014, 2012, 2013, and 2013, 2014, is that due in part to the vehicles needed for the change in solid waste?
I think we it's a combination. I think over the past 2 or 3 years, we have not really purchased a whole lot of vehicles. Each year for the past 2 or 3 years, we have purchased much less, you know, than what was in the plan. We've deferred the purchase of some vehicles. For instance, the fire truck, that was, I think that's a $700,000-$800,000 ticket item that was deferred. I think it's been deferred for 2 years in a row now, and that has been factored in. And, you know, there have been adjustments, and I do believe there are some additional solid waste trucks proposed for.
It's about $500,000 worth of two solid waste trucks, and then a fire truck that's about $700,000. So between those,
so that number reflects.
Yeah,
that.
So that's like 1.2 of that 1.8 is those three items.
Yeah,
and just so we're crystal clear on that point, the reason for some additional solid waste trucks is not simply replacement of some existing equipment, but actually because if we're going to drive our trash to the Durham transfer station or something like that, which is what the decision that our county commissioners have made for us, then every time a trash truck needs to be emptied, it's got to be off of its route and driving back and forth to Durham and being and spending some time in the queue in Durham waiting to be emptied, versus our current arrangement where a truck that needs that gets once a truck is full, right now it goes to Eubanks Road, which takes, you know, half an hour round trip or something like that. Instead, it's going to be an hour and a half, 2 hours round trip to be to go over to Durham and be empty.
It's a combination of the two, of replacement and
in fairness,
and the new landfill.
Correct.
You are
but
correct.
My point being anyway that part of the at least part of the issue there is that making the trip to Durham reduces the amount of time that our trash collectors can be on the street collecting our trash and increases the amount of time that they've got to spend going back and forth to the disposal facility and waiting to empty out at the disposal facility.
And from what George was saying, the nature of the kind of vehicle needed, wasn't that correct? It's a different vehicle?
It's similar to what we use now for dumpsters.
Yeah.
It's similar in that respect with an additional one.
But and that really is the key point. George has just made really what is the key point, which is that we need at least one more truck in order to be able to. It's not just a question of replacing existing equipment, but that another truck is needed in order to be able to accommodate the length of haul that is needed to go to the Durham facility.
I know one of the things that, aside from the cost of the vehicles, there's the cost of running the vehicles and the fuel for the vehicles, which is going to skyrocket when we have to take things to Durham, along with the pollution caused by that. That said, and all of those things cost money that aren't factored into the cost of the vehicle, are there different standards for large vehicles like trash trucks and fire engines? Can you get a more energy-efficient trash truck that's also less polluting? Are they making those? And if they cost slightly more, would that be worth pursuing?
There are now compressed natural gas larger trucks. I've seen the Waste Industries has them out and has invested heavily in that area. Now, they do cost more. I don't have a figure for you, but they do cost more, but are, my understanding, more energy efficient in that respect. Now, however, when they bought the whole fleet of them, and we're looking at one truck, and we have two others that are different trucks. So, but that's what I have seen out there. Apparently, there are, in some discussions that Matt and I had with some folks that when we're talking about the transfer stations, there are hybrids out there, but I don't think the industry is there yet for this size of truck and so forth. But the compressed natural gas trucks apparently available.
I think the essential point is, though, that this is an issue that you're looking at when you're making these acquisition decisions.
We will. It's more than just getting a truck, I'll point out, though. You got to have something to fill it with. So that's another aspect of
all,
it. But,
all of the costs and benefits are mm-hmm. obviously important to consider, but you're – The staff is looking at that issue.
They're on that.
That's
okay.
What I want to be sure.
That was the question.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie, for making that point. It's a concern of mine, too. And it was funny, as I was reading through, I kept reading petrol vehicle. And I was like, oh, that's good. At least we're labeling what it is. But it says patrol vehicle. So, but they are petrol vehicles, and to that point, I think we, seeing that in the next couple of years, we're going to buy a lot of the police vehicles. I think we're missing an opportunity to. Maybe I'm assuming that this research hasn't been done, but I would at least like to see the research and what it is, because I don't know what the standards are. I mean, suitable hybrids or alternative vehicles, they're being evaluated. But what does it actually mean to say suitable hybrids or alternative vehicles? So at some point, I would like to, before the next CIP, get some kind of report in that regard. And like we've brought up in the past, one thing is the monetary cost, but the other thing is the greenhouse gas costs. So I would like to propose having the greenhouse gas emissions costs to vehicles alongside the monetary costs from here going forward, so we can really get a sense of what the approximate true costs of these things are.
Okay. You will have that. We don't have it now, but we're working on it. Because all the things you've talked about, reducing the carbon footprint, the 2% reduction per year, we are going to try to quantify that and demonstrate that the CIP can achieve that.
I'll just add, I think it's, and this is partly based on past experience, but I think it's important to realize that obviously, some functions of town government are more critical than others, and that for some of our departments, the reliability and the performance abilities of the vehicles are considerably more important than others. So it's worth realizing that, nobody ever wants to hear about the fire truck whose battery has gone dead or something like that. Just to make the point that mm-hmm. that
we're not
standards mm-hmm. what standards we would apply to a vehicle that the planning department shares with the inspections department versus what our police cars performance capabilities are, how critical the function is also factors into that. Just to make that point.
And then to that point, I don't want to assume either, and it'd be interesting to see exactly how many times are there hot pursuits that warrant a 90-mile-per-hour car in Carrboro. I'd like to really get a sense of what that actual need is when we come to that.
But when you need it, you need it.
Yeah, you can't go changing vehicles just when you need
let's be fair and say that there's always two sides to this story, mm-hmm. They're inevitable, I wouldn't even say especially with the police department, but especially with the fire department.
Yeah, that's right.
How big of an emergency are you planning for? How critical of an emergency are you planning for? And that's always a difficult calculation to make, and one that we certainly expect that the professionals who run our fire department are in the best mm-hmm. position to make. But I'll just say, when the Phi Gamma Delta house caught on fire in Chapel Hill and was, and people were, young people's lives were at stake and people were killed and so forth, certainly I'm not saying that had anything to do with any shortcomings in our equipment or in Chapel Hill's equipment, but the point is that just that when you're talking about fire equipment and to some degree also police equipment, that having the right equipment is there's no telling what might be at stake.
Mm-hmm. That's our response.
In having that equipment, and some judgment calls are ultimately called for, mm-hmm. and we have to, at some level, recognize that the professionals who are actually responsible for making for being on the hook and actually having to respond, are their opinions are important. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I just want to hear those opinions.
Sure.
At least.
I think that's a very reasonable idea. Sorry, Arch. Go ahead.
In terms of new projects, we have a total of 9 projects. These are called new projects because no funds have been appropriated for these projects, except for the public works facility. We have purchased some land for that facility, and that facility, you know, $14.3 million has been pushed out again to 18-19 and beyond. The Martin Luther King Jr. Park, last year it was pushed out beyond the 6-year mark. This year the master plan for that park needs to be updated, and it is proposed that we update that in 16-17 with construction following the next year. Some time ago, the board made a commitment to the up to $900,000 for the Rogers Road remediation. We have factored that in and have projected spending that over the next 2 years, even though we're not sure exactly when it will be spent, but from the conversation, it seems like it will be spent sooner rather than later, as there was seemed to be some urgency about achieving some goals in the Rogers Road neighborhood. Now, in terms of funding, we're looking at doing installment financing. We use installment financing primarily for the purchase of the vehicles and equipment. We're looking at tapping our capital reserves, the general obligation bonds we successfully sold, so they have now been put into the debt stream. We're also looking at the using general fund and some intergovernmental revenues. The miscellaneous is primarily payment in lieu. In terms of percentages, you know, of those, we're looking at debt. Installment financing would be the largest share of the revenue sources at 59%.
Is that over the course of the entire CIP?
Yes, over the entire 6-year period. Mm-hmm. You know. Now, one of the things, if we were to fully fund this CIP, I'm sure you're wondering, well, what would be the financial impact on the town? The local government commission and the credit rating agencies will be asking that very same question. You know, what's the impact on the town's financial condition, and can they really afford to repay all of this debt? The local government commission and the credit rating agencies do monitor municipalities' debt. The local government commission looks at two things, the debt as a percent of your assessed valuation and debt per capita. They look at that based on the population size of the town. This is the data that for 2011, that's the latest data that they have available for municipalities with a population of 10,000 through $24,989. The goal is to try to be somewhere around the average. In both of the LGC averages, assessed valuation and per capita, in the very far column, you'll see that the town of Carver was a little bit above the average, but we're nowhere near the high level. As you start approaching the high level, it raises concerns. In terms of the credit rating agencies, an acceptable debt limit is 10% of your operating budget. If you begin to bump up against the 20%, they look at that as being a strain, and that's not a good thing.
Arch, while we're on that slide, just go back to that slide for just 1 second. Let's just say, I think it's, if any of you who are listening do not know, the town of Carborough's credit rating was raised, I believe, just about a month ago by Moody's and others to one of maybe the second highest possible rating, I think it is, for any town of our size. And I just wanted to acknowledge that all of our town staff, yourself very much included, Arch, deserve, and Mr. Manager, deserve a lot of credit for the fact that we're recognized as one of basically the very lowest sorts of credit risks for any lender. And that speaks to what a good job our past town department heads and town manager and our current town manager and department heads have done in managing our town budget. So I just want to say thank you and recognize the work that y'all have done to get us to where we are.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And as you pointed out, the financial condition that the town is in today did not happen overnight, and it happened over a long period of time. And I think that you as a board should be commended for your stewardship and direction to the former managers, the present managers, and the staff. You know, it's a collective effort.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's see. Go to, how do I go to the next slide, man?
The top one.
Top one, yeah, the next
There you
one.
Go.
Okay. One of the things I was sitting there looking at, wanted to take a look at our debt per capita in terms of if we don't assume any more debt, you know, if you look at the blue line, you'll notice that our current debt per capita is 487. You know, without any additional debt, that per capita will gradually decrease as we go forward. If we assume the additional debt in the CIP, the red line reflects the trend. The trend is still downward, but not as much as no additional debt. You know, and we begin to come closer to the LGC average. In terms of the operating budget, I pulled some of this data out of the CIP to summarize what the impact on the operating budget would be. In terms, for the current year, our debt service is $1.2 million. Next year, we're looking at $1.5 million, and next year is also the first year that we began repayment of the general obligation bonds that were issued, and next year is also the year where this $1.8 million of vehicle financing included. Then the following year, you notice it goes back to the $1.2 million. And that's a result of some of our debt matures, and we pay that off, and we'll no longer have that. In terms of the capital reserve fund, the current year we have $764,000, and we're looking at that increasing to $1.5 million next year, and then $2 million the year after that. And again, that's going to, the stormwater projects will have to start in 2013-14, which explains part of the jump up in capital reserve. The capital reserve, you know, is basically the PAYGO dollars, you know, where we set aside transfer money from general fund to that capital reserve for future capital projects. Tax rate, in terms of tax rate, if we fund it, this $40 million CIP, we're looking at an average increase of 0.876 cents over the next 5 years. It'll go increase from 7.49 cents in 2013 through 14, and then 2.76 cents in 2015-16.
Can we have a little clarification there?
Hmm?
This is not saying that taxes are going to raise, go up 2.49 cents next year. That's not what it's saying.
This is not what it's saying.
Because somebody could look at that and read 7.49 cent increase in fiscal year 13-14 and be confused. So
yeah, that assumes that if things stay the same and if we funded this entire CIP.
In okay. one fell swoop.
In one fell swoop.
I don't want anybody to look at this one slide and say, I don't want to read a headline that says Carbo proposing 7.5 cent increase. So
no.
that's not what and that says.
No, we're not proposing that. And as
and you wouldn't.
And yes. we would. And we would not.
That's right.
You know, as I stated earlier about the vehicle.
Arch likes his job. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's just be clear about it.
We like this trend of no tax increase.
That's right.
And as you know, we go through lots of gyrations, mm-hmm. evaluations, and putting together the annual operating budget. We have had this type of scenario in past CIP plans, and they have not come to fruition as of yet. I do not anticipate them coming to fruition on my watch.
And I just so we're clear about what that means. I mean, you know, so every year we're looking at all of the various revenue streams yes. and figuring out places potentially to save some money on mm-hmm. various things, mm-hmm. and from time to time making decisions, sometimes tough decisions mm-hmm. about things that might be delayed in the capital improvements plan.
Yeah.
The capital improvements plan is just a plan or just a measurement tool to look at what kinds of things are needed at some point and what it might mean to do mm-hmm. the things that, mm-hmm. that we would like to do. It doesn't always mean that everything, in fact, it almost never means that all the things that are listed in the CIP are actually going to be done on the time frame that's spelled out in the CIP. So some things will have to wait. Mm-hmm. Occasionally things move up. But it depends
yeah.
on exactly what kind of fiscal year we're experiencing and what both the town and our taxpayers are having to deal with. So
Art, given that this isn't an increase in tax rates, could you explain what it is, what it does?
Basically, what it says is that we've got you know, to fund this $40 billion plan, okay, and there are certain assumptions that we build into doing this. Like we make an assumption about how much the valuation of the property would grow. In the last section of the CIP, you know, all those assumptions are set forth in terms of how much can we borrow money for. How much the revenues would increase. You know, we have an assumption about how fast they would grow. We put all that together. We look at the CIP, what we currently have. You know, we know what our current debt is that we owe. Okay, we make some assumptions about the increase in operating expenses. Put all that together. And then we say, if we fund this CIP, and the operative word is if, you know, by year, the way it's laid out, what would it take in terms of the, you know, what is the, I guess the best way to say it is, what is the shortfall that needs to be made up after you looked at all of your revenue projections, your operating expenses, and to fund this, this is what it would take in terms of tax increases. Yeah. Again, the big word is if.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is a plan that's for 2018, 2019.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Very good.
One last little slide and stuff. On the, this is the
wrong way.
Huh?
Other way.
Other way.
Other way.
Next.
Thank you. This is what the impact on the operating budget in terms of percent would be. Again, the blue line, no additional debt. The red line, with additional debt. You know, even with the additional debt, it stays below the 10% level, but it's not as marked as no additional debt.
And 10%, remind us, I mean, 20% is actually the sort of the red line, I mean, or the danger point, according to the credit rating agencies. 10% represents what, an average or something?
10% represents an acceptable level.
10% acceptable.
Below, yeah.
So we're talking about, we're ranging over the course of this plan, if everything in this plan were built,
mm-hmm.
which is a big assumption, we're talking about staying within a range of 6.4 to 8.5, so mm-hmm. all the way through the course of the plan below that 10% acceptable
right.
number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just to be clear.
Okay. The last slide.
Since it's an election year and everything.
Yeah.
not for me, but somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've got, you know, in the CIP, we know that everything can't fit. These are some unfunded projects that have not changed over the past several years. You know, town hall renovations, the gymnasium, local road improvements, the outdoor swimming pool, Robinson Street improvements. Understanding some of these items came out of some of the other master plans and conversations with the community in terms of, you know, where we should be going in the future with some of our facilities. You know, clearly, you know, as you stated, when you look at the CIP, you look at your operating budget, clearly there are challenges and choices, you know, some more difficult than others that will need to be made as we move forward. It's going to require that we take a reasonable and balanced approach because clearly we cannot go out and borrow the money to carry out all of these projects. And that's an overview of the recommended CIP through fiscal year 2018-19. Do you have any additional questions? One of the things that in the recommendation that we've suggested that the board adopt this, but we also like to have feedback from the board on any specific changes or priorities that we need to look at addressing. I think Alderman Slade has put one task out there for us to look at, and in adopting this recommendation, you know, we would request that you include other suggestions, recommendations that you may have.
Lydia.
Thanks, Arch. It's a great report, and it's always kind of exciting to see what we could have. Wish list. 2 points I want to make. One is one of the other unfunded, or I should say funded, 18, 19, and beyond items is the public works facility. And, you know, when you read the description of this, of the current work site, it kind of makes me feel sorry for George and his staff. But I know that's a huge one we've talked about a lot, and I know there's some serious planning and so forth that'll go forward with however that takes takes place, you know, probably in conjunction with not only whatever we end up building at that new facility, but also whatever happens to the current site, which is kind of restricted, you know, with floodplain and so on. But that's one that I, you know, sometime we're going to have to kind of be setting our eyes on. The other that's in our plan right now, which I'm pleased to see, is the town commons grounds improvement. And, you know, all of us that are out at the farmer's market and different events out there see the sense behind studying ways to try to bolster that area out there. That makes a lot of sense. So.
Other comments on this?
I also had a question about the public works facility land. Is that how much of that still needs to be paid for? What's the balance on that? And you, if you don't know
let
right
me
now,
get
just
back
get
with
back
you on that so I can give you the exact.
Yeah, and if you could let us know, I don't remember what year it was purchased, and if I would just like to see some information on that.
All right, that'd be helpful.
Lydia? I was going to move the resolution.
Okay, well, I just wanted to make maybe one last point. Could you go back, I don't know, about 8 or 10 slides to where you were showing some of the things that we had that we have done in recent years, or the current projects maybe? Yeah, that one. You get there eventually. Here we go. Yeah, slide 5. I just wanted to make the point that I think, you know, a capital improvements plan ideally should reflect both what a community's kind of needs are in terms of ongoing maintenance and that kind of thing, safety, but also on what the community's values are. And that when I look at what you have listed there under current projects and see that what it looks like over $7 million of what you have listed there are bicycle and pedestrian improvements in our community out of about $11 million total that's going on right now. I just think it's worth noting how that kind of reflects what I think it reflects what our community is all about. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, makes me feel good and makes me feel like our town government is doing what the people of Carrboro want to see. So thank you all.
Well said.
All right.
So you moved it. I'll second it.
All right, it's been moved and seconded for the resolution. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. That brings us to item D2, recommendation for creative agency to assist the town with a branding and marketing strategy. Yeah, thank you, Arch, and everybody who works in the finance department. I know all our department heads help collaborate on creating that, but you guys are the ones who are kind of both primarily and ultimately responsible. Thanks.
I would have to recognize Sandy Sabota, who coordinates.
Stand up for a second,
yes,
Sandy. I know you're shy, but yay, thank you, Sandy.
Thank
and
you,
Arch,
Sandy.
And everybody. All right. Mr. Manager.
All right, and that's set to go.
Hello again.
Hello.
Can you help me with which buttons to get the overhead mic? Perfect. Well, this evening has been long in the making. A lot of work has gone into coming to you this evening to make a recommendation for an agency to help lead us in a branding marketing effort. That's something that you all as a board have adopted several plans and talked a lot about over the years. And so we've come to this moment in time where the ESC has done a lot of work to try to select an agency that's going to help lead the town do that and make a recommendation to you all this evening. First off, I just want to describe a little bit about that process that the town and the ESC have gone through. We did go through an RFQ process where the opportunity to submit an submit qualifications was advertised, RFQs were sent out to firms. There were 7 firms that we actually sent RFQs out to. And there were 3 who responded to the town. And of those 3 firms, the ESC reviewed all of the submissions, and they interviewed all 3 of the firms. And in your packets, you've got a matrix of how they went through an evaluation process. 2 of the firms were very, very close, and there was a lot of discussion that went into it. But ultimately, the ESC is recommending to you all tonight that the Splinter Group be selected as the agency that'll, again, help lead us forward. And I'm going to go ahead and start delighting you with some images that will look very familiar and sort of define, you know, who they are and the kind of work that they have done in the community and around the state. Very, very well known, very beautiful work that they do. Tonight, Steve Balcom and Lane Worcester are here with the Splinter Group and are open to answer any questions for you. And also our chairperson, Terry Turner, is here, and Sarah Blackland from our ESC. So I wanted to point out that they are here, again, to kind of show you some of the work that they already do and brands that you're probably very familiar with that are all the Splinter Group. The ESC wanted to point out that they had a lot of local knowledge, and their relationships within the community really made them the most qualified firm for this process. So, again, just kind of giving you some of the, reminding you of some of the clients that they have and work that they do. And with that, I'll make that recommendation. I think that our chair lady would like to say a couple of words to you this evening about the process that the ESC went through and the selection and all the recommendation. Right. So.
Very good. Terry Turner.
Hello. As Annette said, this was a pretty exhaustive process. Multiple meetings, multiple interviews, lots of discussion, and it became pretty clear that the Splinter Group was like the cream. They kept rising to the top. You know, they live here, they work here, they're so connected to our community. Some of the past work they did, for me in particular, I guess for the whole group, they worked with the Weaver Street Market, which has bunch of groups. Sarah can speak to that too, the farmers, the co-op owners, the workers, and the community, and the Splinter Group was able to navigate all those stakeholders and come up with a product that they all were proud of. And one of the logos up there was the Emerson Waldorf School, and they worked with them as well. And if any of you know the Emerson Waldorf School, they're a very independent community, and the Splinter Group worked with them. And those were some of the references that they came through with, and it just reinforced what we were thinking. And I think they're the perfect agency, and I think they're well-suited to lead this project.
All right. Great. Thank you. Those of you from the Splinter Group, could you just stand up for just a second and wave to us? Now, if those guys don't look like Carborough, come on now. All right. I just wanted to say, Randy and then Jackie.
Well, I, you know,
having witnessed the unfolding of the process, it was quite deliberative, and you know, it was very interesting to hear the splinter group talk about their process and where they've come from. I was personally very taken with their journey to where they are, and I think that very much spoke of Carrboro coming from music background and talking about Carrboro in their first sharing in terms of Carrboro's vibe. So you had me at the vibe. But one of the projects that they did, and I don't know that a lot of people know, but the process brought it out, was the project called The Good Egg with, was it Audubon?
Yeah, Audubon, North Carolina.
Yeah, and that was, it showed the depth to which you understood the values of the organization, which is kind of different than doing restaurant logos. And so I think that's very exciting, and I'd like to move the item and get these guys on board.
Jackie.
I'll second it, but I want to strongly encourage everybody involved to be in touch with the Carrboro Art Commission, not the Arts Center. It's a different organization, the Carrboro Arts Commission, which is in touch with our artist, which already has its own logo. After, I think, probably 1,700 hours of meeting, we have a logo, so probably don't want that messed with. And they're anxious to be involved. And the Arts Commission asked me to talk about using the Arts Commission logo on some giveaways for our upcoming festivals this spring. We have a little bit of money left in our budget, and they'd like to put the Arts Commission logo on, like, water bottles or something and give them out at the festivals as we begin moving forward with the branding. So everybody involved, I'd like to just put that out there. And thank you. It's exciting, and I'll second it with that.
All right, very good. Lydia.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I'm in strong support of the motion. Love your work. When I look at all those logos, I'm not surprised that those are all ones that you were involved with. And I particularly liked your essay. So.
I'll second.
I did.
Those ideas.
You got a third it by now. Yeah, I mean, this is certainly a company, and we actually have a fair number of people in our community who are very talented and knowledgeable about marketing. But I think this company, since long before this process, this is a company that has always kind of stood out in my mind with just the not only the aesthetic appeal of the work that they do, but the way that their logos and branding get not even our community, but get the essential nature of the companies that they're doing their work for. Anyway, there's something about every one of those examples we just saw that really kind of speaks to who each of those entities are. And I think this kid yourself not. This will be a particular challenge, I think. Not everybody in this community even feels that we need branding or that we need marketing. And I think when other communities talk about branding and marketing, they probably have a different, not just a different feel, but a different goal in mind from what our community does. So, I have a lot of reasons to be optimistic that you guys get that. And so looking forward to working with y'all. All right, it's been moved and seconded and thirded even. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, and I pass unanimously. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
All right, and not too far off that topic, that brings us to item D3, website redesign presentation. Mr. Manager.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Mayor, we've been looking at redesigning the website. Andy and a lot of his team have done a lot of research, and they're getting ready to formally start the effort, and so we thought this would be a good time to let you know where the project stands and maybe give us some thoughts and direction for how we proceed.
Yes, good evening.
Hello, everyone. This is the town website refresh beginning with a focus on creating a community website, a one-stop source for Carrboro-related information, and not just the dry government-related information, but stuff, what's going on in the community, interesting events we're having, community events we're having in our various parks and stuff like that, when baseball season begins, when you can register, stuff like that. We also keep in mind the relevance to the various users that we have. We'll try to keep it so the site can flow for residents looking for information on the site versus businesses versus visitors. And we'll keep the content up to date and timely. That'll be very important going forward. We're in the process of seeking input. We've created a staff work group, as David said, to manage the process and to ensure its success over the long term. This group will stay together even after the site is built to make sure that it's responding to the needs of the community. We're going to do some community outreach, 1 to 2 moderated community input work sessions, depending on how they're attended, also an online survey, and we'll be back for Board of Aldermen input also. The three major elements to this website redesign or refresh, there's a website redesign itself, and that's going to give it all a new look and feel. It'll incorporate new navigation, new organization, new functionality. It'll hopefully, we're looking at creating a portal so people can sign into the website and they can actually tailor it to what they want to get in terms of notifications they want to receive, in terms of calendars they want to have active on their calendar page. For instance, they have a calendar that follows things at Reckon Park and follows advisory with certain advisory boards, so to tailor to their needs. And like I said, the notification is going to be a really nice thing because they can receive in multiple different ways information sent to them so they can get it in the way that they can consume the information best for them. We'll support RSS feeds, updating Twitter and Facebook, our Twitter and Facebook pages also. And make note that we'll also incorporate design elements of the town branding efforts. The next thing is, the next major element of this whole redesign is a major enhancement to the Board of Aldermen meeting and video streaming. It'll be full integration between the agendas, the minutes, and the actual streaming meeting videos. There'll be much improved compatibility for Apple. As you know, if you've used our site in the past, we've had issues with Apple users, and hopefully this will resolve that. Also improved reliability. And to kind of show you an example, that we kind of know where we're heading with right now. This is a product that we're looking at and have actually proceeded on purchasing. We're using the City of Winston-Salem site. But essentially, you'll be able to search our agendas. And then let me just go down a little bit further here. Like here's an example of a regular meeting. If you went to a regular meeting, you'll have the ability to see, and this will take a second to come up. This is due to the security that software that's on this computer. But it should pop up here in a second. It's not that slow. It is the software that's on this computer. And anyway, it'll have like the meeting video that pops up immediately for this particular agenda. On this right side, you'll have a document view of what the agenda will look like. Let me go over here. And so you can see the actual agenda. If you were to click on these links, it would show you portions, you know, of that agenda, those agenda items. The real nice bit is down here. And this screen is not a very high resolution. This is not the size that most people would see. They'd see more on the screen at one time. But if you scroll down through here, the town clerk will be able to actually bookmark the agenda so that if you want to see a certain part of the agenda.
Hey, it's the mayor.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'll pause that. Apologize. For instance, you want to go to ordinance authorizing the use of power of eminent domain. If you were to click on that, it would go immediately to that. If I had
put it on the list.
And there it goes immediately to that. So right. It's really nice. It's a really nice way to make that, because that's why people, yeah, they want to see it, the actual witnessing what's occurring compared to just reading about it. It's a great way to get information to the user and make them understand what actually occurred at that meeting. So that's a nice
And they're
thing.
Advertising themselves as one of the top 10 digital cities, so now maybe we'll be in the top 10, huh?
Oh, fantastic. That's great. Okay.
Andy, will our old videos and minutes and everything be on the new site?
Yes, they won't be on necessarily integrated with that format because the time to move all that stuff over would be pretty,
right,
you know, pretty intense. It'd take a lot of time to do that, but they'll still be available in the current format.
Okay.
If it becomes meaningful that it should be moved over there, the possibility does exist, but probably the best way is keep what we have, and then everything going forward will be on this new format.
Okay.
And then the final thing that's the third major element of this redesign it's kind of like the behind-the-scenes thing. It's an implementation of agenda and minutes workflow management solution. And that's what allows it kind of it's really nice because right now it's a very paper-intense, employee-intense. You have to shuffle stuff around, hand stuff off, scan stuff past each other. Mm-hmm. Now it'll all be done online, essentially. People will basically attach items to it, will type into it. It'll format the document out automatically. Mm-hmm. It'll pass it on for approval, so we have a workflow to it that takes approvals into account. So it allows us to more efficiently manage the entire legislative mm-hmm. process. So that should be a time saver and a money saver for us in the long run, freeing employees to do better things. And that also gives a lot of the power, the back-end power, to the major enhancement to the Board of Aldermen meeting and video combination. Mm-hmm. So the next steps, we're going to hold a community input work sessions, and as I said, one or two, depending on the number of people who attend. The first one we're looking at the end of February, and we will, through our normal avenues, let people in our normal channels, let people know when that will be. But we are looking at the 27th and 28th of February, most likely. And we'll receive that and process that input, that work group, the staff work group will do that. And then we'll begin site construction. And the site construction, what's great about that is that we can build it in parallel to the one that we're running right now. So we can come back to the Board of Aldermen and say, hey, this is how we're progressing through it. Is this meeting your expectations? And if not, we can adjust it along the way without ever, altering our current website. That's going in just in tandem, basically. And then when you guys are comfortable with it, we can bring it up and take the current one down. So, and the very important thing, we will keep the Board of Aldermen updated on the progress throughout this. And we're looking to plan go live in the fall of 2013. That's when it should be coming up. So, are there any thoughts or any input you'd like to convey at this moment?
You're a brave man.
Yeah.
Well, we have a great work group. We really do. We've actually been working on this for about the last 6 months. We started in July, and we've been getting together, and we have a lot of, one good thing for the town of Carrboro is that we have experience doing it currently, so, and we've gotten a lot of feedback from people telling us what could be better, what could be improved, and we've always made note of that, and now is our time to do those changes.
Right.
Yeah, I guess my one comment would be the one that I just made, that I find myself occasionally when we have an item come up, doing the legislative history on it, if you will, looking back at our old agendas or old minutes, so I understand you don't want to put them all into the new format, but if we can remember that citizens also like to have a way to just kind of look back at those old ones, let's not cut that tie.
Understand.
I have a couple of thoughts. Go ahead.
Well, are we going to keep the current arrangement or the current way that we tag the code and the land use ordinance, or are we looking at a muni code thing or keeping what we have, or have we thought through that yet?
We haven't totally thought through that yet. I need to work with the town clerk, and the work group has to work with the town clerk, and we need to discuss that because it's going to take some thought, to be honest with you, and that's something that we're still kind of figuring out, what's the best way to present that, because yeah, it will. We're going to have to think about that a little bit further.
That search engine's nice, but it's for that design.
Exactly. That will go away. And there's a lot of people who didn't like that search engine, and so hopefully we'll make one that's easier for people to use, that's more straightforward, that you can use logical operators, and not, stuff like that, that some people are used to. So we hope it will get only better, is the kind of bottom line. And there may be a separation of the search from the website itself and from things such as you're discussing, like land use ordinance and the agendas and stuff like that. There may be different engines that drive both of those.
So I have three points of input, and I think some of these are undoubtedly, based on your presentation, already under consideration. But number one is the thing that I probably hear the most about from residents of our town is number one, the fact that for most or maybe all of our various advisory boards and committees, that their agendas are not available online in advance of the meetings. So I hope that you will mm-hmm. figure out a way that all of that sort of workflow stuff you were talking about will address that mm-hmm. that issue. Minutes.
Yeah,
of past meetings for that matter as well, mm-hmm. but which is, I think, is an interesting point, but I got to tell you that it's the agendas for upcoming committee meetings mm-hmm. that I and especially the planning board, because people are always interested in or inevitably the things that are that people are the most interested in are things that are coming for our planning board. Second point that I hear about from a smaller group of people, but I still think they have a point, is that our current website and also the web presence of some of our neighboring municipal governments are very one way in terms of it's all about how do we get our information out to you and not nearly as much about how does the public get information to us about problems and issues and concerns that they have or whatever. I don't have a specific suggestion about how you address that issue, but I want to say I do hear from time to time from people who feel like they want to see more of a two-way communication portal from our town website or for that matter from whatever sort of social media presence or those sorts of things. And the third thing is not something that I hear from the public about a lot, but that I personally have a concern about. So working, and this is, I'm going to analogize with the county level governments, but working with real estate issues a lot the way that I do, I have from time to time occasion to have to look at real estate records from Orange County online or from Alamance, Chatham, Durham, and occasionally other counties further afield. And what I find is that for every county, each and every county I've ever had to look at real estate information on their website, every one of them has a different technology. Every one of them has something that's proprietary. None of them ever use any commonly found format. They all have their own unique thing. Sometimes I've got to download some stupid application. Oftentimes I've got to close out of the web browser I'm using and reopen in a different web browser because only certain browsers are supported. I guess the point is that to the extent that we make our information available through proprietary software, through in other words, branded software that only works with that can only be operated via an application that's run and designed by one particular company, that what we're doing is freezing out people who don't have a technology that's compatible with that. And it seems I gotta say, in the real estate world, it seems particularly ridiculous because all you ever want to look at is some sort of a scan of some sort of printed document, and in the four counties right around where we live to have four different technologies, four different software packages, four different sets of system requirements just seems ridiculous. And my point being, anyway, in short, that it seems like scanned images are not some kind of innovative, cutting-edge technology. This is not something where I need some specialty corporation to come in and design a software package that will allow the town of Carrboro to deliver scanned images of documents to be seen by the public, or at least by that portion of the public that happens to have the same technology that they have deemed to be the dominant technology. Anyway, you get where I'm headed, that the more that we head toward open source sorts of file formats so that we're leaving things as open as possible to, I don't care whether you're on, my point is, it shouldn't matter whether you have a Mac or whether you're operating Windows or what version of Windows you're running or whether you're on the Chrome OS or whether you're one of these Ubuntu freaks. Point is that the more that we get away from proprietary file formats and into file formats that are readable by a wide range of technology, I think not only is the better off that the public is, but the better off that we are in terms of not having to constantly be trying to adjust to whatever the latest trend is in software technology for the future. So I just want to put that out there. As, to the extent that I'm not saying that it should be at the sacrifice of convenience or functionality or cost, but in fact, my point is quite the opposite, that by staying away from these proprietary packages that are designed especially for to rip off local governments, that we ought to be able to achieve the highest level of kind of reach to the public and the lowest cost by having the least proprietary technology needed on our end or on the consumer's end. So I got to put that out there. All right. Is there?
I just had a suggestion that's not directly related to it, but it is. Once we get this spiffy new hard come-by website that you guys are working so hard on, I think it would be nice if we invested in a couple of very sturdy kiosks throughout the town so that people, you know, who don't have their own iPad or don't have an iPhone or don't have a whatever or just don't have it with them, so that there's one at the entrance to the Century Center and there are one or two in the entry hall here. Good non-stealable stuff that if somebody walks into town hall and wants some information, bam, it's right there in front of them. I think we could invest in that. And we could also use that with our branding. I would very much like to see us have our new website with links to the surrounding community, to our businesses as part of that. And we could have that, if we could come up with something sturdy enough, at different points downtown, so that if you're in downtown Carrboro and you want to buy a pair of shoes or have a vegan dinner, that you can go into the kiosk. So I think all
and
of
find what you're looking
and
for.
Find what you're looking for. I would like our website, if it doesn't have that with it when we kick it off, to be capable of that. So it's kind of a gateway, just like our streets are a gateway into our town, so it's a gateway into the town, and our businesses and entertainment and all of that are accessible through it and to a wide range of people. And I'm not saying that that has to be done by fall 13, but I'd like us to be to that point where if you're coming to Carrboro from Massachusetts, you only have to put in Carrboro once to right. see who and what we are.
So that's that we great. Don't have to do all of this again in order to get to
right.
that point
right.
When the technology is there.
I love it. Great
okay.
idea.
Great point, Jackie. All right. Is there a motion for... Is,
we just
resolution.
Need to accept the presentation.
Okay. Is there a motion to accept the presentation?
So moved.
Okay.
With thanks.
Second. Much thanks.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. We accept the presentation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
Mark, may I just ask if we could move the fences regulation ahead of the legislative, because Alan Spalt's here for that item. And
does it want to sit there on legislative discussion?
I'd be willing to do that, what I want to do first is have just like maybe a three-minute break.
Okay.
So he'll have to sit through the three-minute break, and then we'll get to fences.
Thanks.
All right,
I appreciate
great.
That.
We'll reconvene in 3 minutes.
All right, good evening. Welcome back. We're on item D5, a review of regulations related to fences, Mr. Manager.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Tina Moon will make the staff report. This was an issue that was brought up by our citizen and former board member Alan Spall. Tina.
Once again, this was something brought up as a citizen request to kind of look at our provisions related to fencing and see if there may be some need to look at potential changes. You have a pretty good little report in your packet, so I won't go into great detail. In short, we did receive this inquiry in November of 2011. And a request to look at our provisions for fencing. Historically, our references to fences have really focused on two areas. The main one is really this notion of a fence that goes along parallel to a right-of-way, and the way I read it, if it's a visual obstruction. So it has to do with if the fence greater than 3 feet in height and if it's opaque, something that would create kind of a visual barrier. The second reference really has to do with screening, so I don't really think that that's something we need to focus on tonight. It's really more this issue of visual obstruction. There was, for those of you who do like to look at the archives of minutes, there's considerable discussion on fences in the 90s, particularly in 98 and 99. And subsequent to that discussion, some ordinance amendments were put in place. And through that process, the key issues, again, had to do with this notion of fences running parallel to right-of-ways. It goes into great discussion about double-fronted lots. And it also talks about an expressed desire not to establish gated communities. The berm is just kind of a sidebar, but it's not really pertinent to our discussion. The shift, I think, has happened more recently. There's been a renewed interest in gardening as a form of energy conservation and energy conservation in general. And in 2009, the town kind of went out on a limb to seek special legislation to prevent subdivisions from using covenants as a way to prevent some of these energy-saving measures. I think we've all heard about the laundry line issue. And so forth. Well, garden fences were actually included as one of these special energy-saving devices. The other changing trend, which has happened at the same time, and I think we're all aware of it, is an increase in the deer population. So the response to that is we now have a lot of local citizens who are building garden fences which are designed to be high enough to prevent deer from getting in them. And so these are typically quite high, you know, 6 in some cases. I don't know if we have here, but the recommended specification for deer fencing is often as 6 or 8 feet, and it's often double layered, so to speak, with the main fence and an outer fence to prevent jumping with some type of a heavy duty framework around the outside. And incidentally, I have the offending fence in this little collage, but I won't point it out directly. Should you wish to consider options for changing the ordinance, here are some things just to keep in mind. One, developing ordinances for aesthetic purposes can be challenging. Some possible approaches that I've identified in the little report is to maybe identify fences by their function or their type of construction. If you look through the land use ordinance, I think we now provide a definition for berm. We really don't provide a definition for fence. That might be one area, just a matter of clarification. We might amend the ordinance for all fences or just particular kinds of fences, such as deer fencing. I think a key thing you want to keep in mind is that whatever change you may wish to make is we want to remember this section 15-83.3 that you've gone to such lengths to get, you know, and not do something that would conflict with that. Restricting garden location in terms of the fence location based on visibility, what you would see from the right-of-way, has a little bit of a challenge when you're talking about a garden fence because the garden needs to be where the sun is. So that may be kind of an uphill battle. And finally, here in Carrboro, fences do not typically require any kind of a permit, and I suspect that they typically do not in most locations. So should you wish to impose a permit requirement for fencing, there'd be a little bit of a learning curve involved with that, just outreach to the community and so forth to get everyone up to speed. Also, in the little report, there were a number of suggestions which former Alderman Spalt included in his correspondence to the town. So I will kind of remind those to you, and he's certainly here if he'd like to add to those or to clarify what he had in mind.
Okay. I believe that Alan Spalt wanted to address the Board of Aldermen about this. If you'll go ahead and come up, and then we'll have a discussion.
Good evening. I'm Alan Spalt. As most of you know, I live on James Street, and I wrote this letter to the town because when this particular fence was constructed, it was a cause of quite a lot of discussion in the neighborhood. There were some new folks moving in, and they had a company build what was really a massive, looks like a stockade more than a garden fence. Some of you I know saw it when it was going up. I want to make a couple of things clear. One is, we're not asking for any change in the fence that's there for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I don't think it's possible, but that's not the only reason. It's also grown in a little bit. The folks are really nice. They aren't. They're really nice. And I've talked to them about it. They know about the meeting tonight and understand that no one is asking you to do anything about that fence. What I am asking you to do, and what other neighbors reason, I probably wouldn't have written the letter if we were the only ones, even though it's right across the street from us. It's on a corner of Rainbow and James, so that this fence is out at the corner. So one of the things that Tina said was that the earlier discussion dealt with fences along rights-of-way. This is on two rights-of-way, one right out to it, one not quite so far because there were a couple of little fruit trees. About 20 6x6 posts, eight and a half feet tall with not unattractive but substantial framework. We're in Carborough have been pretty strict about what we regulate, what we call a building. And when this fence went up, it looked like it might be a building. and I think that the considering the question of mass and size, location, density, scale is something that makes this more than just your typical garden fence. If you drove by when it was being built, people weren't really sure what it was going to be used for because it really was massive. I want to make clear that I have no quarrel with the provision in the ordinance, which I didn't realize you got by special legislation, to not limit garden fences by ordinance and so forth, or by homeowner association agreements. I think that's good. There are actually now a number of fences in our neighborhood, including at least one in a front yard, that are garden fences to protect against deer that are not unattractive and not inappropriate, and everybody understands why, on top of an ordinary fence, if it's in the front yard, or, you know, extending it up with sort of lightweight poles to put mesh around it, or in a backyard, what might have once been just a small privacy fence is now substantially taller because of deer. We had more than a dozen deer run through our backyard over Christmas. So we've got deer. And if you've got a garden, you need to protect against it. The question here is not whether or not it's a garden, whether or not it's a garden fence. The thing to think about, I think, is what happens if many of these should appear around Carborough in people's front yards. It would really change the character of a residential area to have this kind of substantial structure there. And I was a little bit surprised, knowing, you know, I memorized the ordinance, but I did deal with it, that it didn't require a permit because it was so substantial. And I think that might be a way to go. I'm also not completely clear what the definition of opaque is. I see some language in the ordinance. I'm not sure whether that's really the definition. But as I understand it, you can build anything you want so long as it's not opaque for more than 3 feet. But I don't know what the degrees of opaqueness are, what makes it within limits or not, because there's a lot of fencing that's kind of woven that you can see through some, but not too much. Is that opaque or not opaque? I mean, clearly you couldn't build a brick wall, but this would not be very attractive if it were opaque. It's not. It's not the issue for this fence. But you could make something like this fence that was substantially opaque and probably make the case that you could see through it so it passes. And that, I think, is something that you might want to consider, because there are quite a number of people who have built fences that are, you know, the height of your table here, that are picket or more than that, and then have smaller poles going up to hold mesh, and they're not, the sense is totally different than what this is if this kind of fence became common. So I don't know if that helps you. But that's sort of the situation. Any questions?
I just wanted to make a comment.
Yeah.
You know, I became aware of this particular fence because I was riding north as it was being built on James and approaching the Rainbow intersection. And so I was aware during different stages it was being built. And when it was finally, I guess it wasn't even completely built out, I was making that, because I make that trip every day, and I noticed as I was approaching the Rainbow intersection that, you know, there was something, I could see the light shifting on the far side of the fence, and I wasn't sure exactly what it was, and I had a stop sign. And, you know, a kid on a bike, probably coming from McDougal, was flying through that intersection. And lucky enough that, you know, the change in light, and you know how that is when there's a moving object behind another object, you get that flickering, you know, caused me to really wait and look. So I was really surprised that a structure as thick and built up as this was could be so close to an intersection and create, you know, the lack of visual sighting on that corner going west. It's not the same kind of problem when you're coming south, but it definitely presents that problem going north, looking west. So I had kind of a different take when Alan's email came across. You know, I'm concerned that there needs to be some way to evaluate not only opacity, but the way in which the kinds of materials that are being used and whether they create, obstacles to the visual.
Maybe it is in part education, because if you're trying to have a garden and the darn deer cease being cute and become pests and destroy hundreds of dollars worth of vegetables, then you put up a fence that makes your tomatoes cost about $10 each by the time you pay for the fence. But Maybe because that's the only kind of fence you know to put up. So if we could come up with some simple designs that were, like Alan was talking about, some nice little picket fence with poles and then meshing going up higher so that visually it wasn't as jarring or different in a neighborhood, and start educating people and maybe encourage our local building supply places and southern states to carry the materials for this, so that we could kind of create a norm in Carborough that if you want to keep the deer out, here's a cool way to do it. I would really hate to see us as a bureaucracy and the community as individuals have to deal with the nightmare of creating a permit for, you know, because you might need a fence in May and you can't put it up till July, you know?
Or worse yet, you put it up in May and find out you need a permit in July.
Exactly, exactly. So maybe if instead we could begin educating people on some, you know, aesthetically acceptable as well as effective fence designs to keep the deer out. And I presume that the more gardens we protect from deer, the less deer we're going to have. You know?
Eventually. Lydia.
Yeah, you know, it's a real challenge, right? I mean, the fence that near Alan's house, I think we've all seen it, and it's probably the best example of what we would not want to see. Mm-hmm. The horrors of permitting, though, or, you know, I mean, I can't even imagine. I know I was thinking of our neighborhood. I think four or five of my immediate neighbors have fences around gardens. Most of them are in the front yard. Mm-hmm. Most of them wouldn't have any idea that they would, even with outreach. I just don't think they would know to go get a permit. And most of them, none of them are obtrusive. But, you know, that's the slippery slope and trying to figure out how to regulate this if we did. And, you know, it depends on so many factors. You know, if it's on the side of the yard or the backyard, it's different than the front. And we certainly don't want to discourage it, right? I mean, we have an ordinance that encourages it. So it's a quandary, but it does seem that what we want to try to somehow discourage or not allow are obtrusive or unsafe fencings. And how we do that, I'm still trying to kind of think through it.
I like Jackie's idea, and I think in the same way that rock walls are known to be of our area, you know, along Franklin Street, there are other materials that are of our area, such as cedar posts. And like we've identified the kinds of bike racks that we prefer being used in town, as we develop this new website, we may have a section of these kinds of things. Like, for example, where I live, we're trying to figure out where to source a bike rack, and if that were readily available through our website, then maybe we would have already gotten a bike rack. But along with fencing, we could have, you know, information about where to get cedar posts for cheap, and you know, links to how to best construct. I think what I heard from Alan is the concern that this kind of fencing could proliferate and become overwhelming if it happened everywhere. And thankfully, and unfortunately, it's in your neighborhood, but it's not everywhere right now. And so to the degree that we could encourage what is more of a local type of fence, I think that would be the better route. I think the ordinance currently does address to a high degree kind of what the concern is of the opaque fence on street right-of-ways. And so it gets at the safety issue. And I also hear, Alan, it's not so clear as to what degree it's opaque or not, you know, so that is kind of our challenge, I think.
And I don't think this one would have been if the definition was more clear.
Uh-huh.
But it's not opaque. It's not opaque. Capacity is not an issue in this fence, mm-hmm. But people suggested, what if they planted vines all the way around it?
Right.
Yeah.
The deer would eat the vines.
Well,
but let me just finish.
Go ahead.
One thing that did strike me as you were describing this fence is the fact that they were newcomers to the neighborhood, and it was after getting to know them that kind of the first concerns were blunted a bit. So I'm very much encouraged by the potential for more neighborliness to be forgiving for aesthetics that otherwise might be offending. So it's just, I don't know, at some point we have to rely on each other's humanness and neighborliness to get over and around some things that we may not necessarily agree with. For lack of better being able to define exactly like some of the concerns that you described, you know, what degree of opaqueness, I think that personally, I think that's probably the best we could do unless I hear of a better idea.
Sammy, I think I agree with a lot of that. Somebody who has put the thought even better, if not fully more succinctly, hopefully other former Alderman Jay Bryan is watching tonight because he'll appreciate this. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go. To each the boulders have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls. We have to use a spell to make them balance. When they're stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game. One on a side. It comes to little more. There, where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where the cows are? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I asked to know what I was walling in or walling out and to whom I was likely to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors. That's a poem. It is 99 years old. And I think there's plenty more in that than in our conversation today. But it seems to me that, you know, the problem is ultimately that very few zoning ordinances in America address this issue in any significantly more detail than we do. And that I'm just afraid that trying to get too technical and too detailed on this particular subject will come as a surprise to too many people in the future. And while I agree that some of the sort of hypothetical scenarios spun tonight could be problems, that I also think the ordinance actually, as it's written now, does address those problems, and that it's not so much that good neighbors make good fences, or not so much that good fences make good neighbors as that good neighbors make good fences, and that this is something that's maybe better left in the realm of relying on people to be good neighbors and to make good fences. So I personally am not quite yet persuaded that some new legislation is needed.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, to this question of vines growing on the fence, would that all of a sudden constitute opacity? And if that did happen, then would it be triggered?
Let me point out, for example, that for many years at the corner of Shelton Street and Oak Avenue in Carborough, there was a huge hedge that blocked the view around the corner of the intersection and mm-hmm. was a significant hazard. But there was no fence at the center of it. You know, it was really just the plant life itself that was a problem. And while, you know, I agree that hypothetically vines can grow up a fence and become and make it opaque and become a problem, it's actually that sort of thing is no less a problem in places where fences are absent. You know, where you have a sharp intersection, there's always the potential for the plant life to grow up to a point where it's an issue. And somebody got out there periodically and cut it back. I think actually it might have been Carborough Public Works that periodically went out there and cut it back to improve the visibility at the corner. The current homeowner there seems to have come along and mowed it down altogether to really kind of solve the problem for at least another 20 years or so. But I guess my point is, you know, it seems like many of those sorts of issues can be dealt with as they come up. And, you know, you can connect all those defenses, but it's vegetation at the corner is an issue whether there's a fence there or not. And we have a set of rules that deal with that problem whether there's a fence there or not. And, you know, I'm sorry if some particular homeowner hasn't necessarily made the best decision or hasn't necessarily brought the best approach to it. But I think, you know, my experience is that my neighbors, two of my neighbors have built fences. I guess they really don't want to see me. But in both cases, they had sort of the good taste to come and discuss it with me a little bit first. And, you know, that the best approach is to rely on people on good neighbors to make good fences. That's my thought.
Well, I really like what Jackie had to say and, you know, and Sammy's point. And I'm wondering if, as we look towards this community website, if there's some recommendations that we can seek to make so that if folks are looking to the town for some guidance on this, we're not just directing them to an ordinance that they've got to read through, but that we can make some recommendations about things to watch out for. And maybe number one is talk to your neighbors.
Yeah, I don't want to legislate it at all. I just want to give people some ideas of this is a nice looking fence.
And yeah. I think that's a fine idea.
And I would suggest maybe not even wait till the new website. I mean, you know, people are planning things like this right now. And
right.
Building, I mean, not that we need to have staff to run out tomorrow, but, you know, just somehow, you know, some kind of information or thought or, I don't know, put together some informational brochures or and get them to the usual places.
Even ask, like, Fitch and Southern State if they would, you know, this is what we're encouraging. You might want to have this stuff on hand, you know.
So what would we want to add to Attachment A? Because there's space for us to do so. What kind of language do we want to add to that? Because I like what's being said, but I think we need to.
Well, we would need to research it some, because you certainly don't want me drawing the fence.
So, we're recommending for staff to look into a set of recommendations.
See what they already have. I mean, maybe I'm sure that somewhere out there somebody's designed an attractive deer fence. Because we're not the first people to go, ooh.
We could work on some piece of literature that we could put in the front lobby, you know, for folks. There's a lot of racks out there for people to pick up things, and that's another one that maybe we could come up with
best practices. And put it out at the farmer's market, because people walk through there and go, I want a garden. I better get a fence.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sure if there are some better materials that folks at Fitch and companies like that would be eager to
Fitch
know what they are.
States.
Well, it's one we can email out to our neighborhood that serves also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Get the information out.
And affordable, I mean, one thing about the reluctance to shoot deer in town is that folks who don't have much money to invest in a fancy fence, you know, or even a fence, you know, are affected. So I would encourage staff to not just look at aesthetics, but also the low-cost aspect of it.
All right, so I'll take that as a motion for resolution with sort of the staff will kind of gather the tenor of the conversation here and move forward along those lines. Is there a second? Jackie, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed are passed unanimously.
And can we call it the good neighbors make good fences? Or, I love that twist of words, Mark. That's very cool.
Thank you. All right, I believe that brings us to my web connection is down. I know, but I'm just saying. Well, but let's go to the legislative agenda issue real quick, and let me give suggest a little bit of context, which is that for many years past, there have not been all that many people in the General Assembly who cared that much about what we thought is especially true now.
There are fewer now.
I just want to suggest that we focus on whatever few items are really particularly essential. I feel like one of the things in our agenda here packet here is the North Carolina League of Municipalities agenda, and I feel like there are some things that I agree with, some things I don't agree with, and some things that I just don't understand, and that rather than belaboring all of those or even any of those, that we just confine our conversation to ones that are particularly important and relevant to Town of Harborough. So that's just my suggestion for some context. Lydia and Emery.
I'll just give two broad ones, and we have some other broad ones perhaps, but I know one that is in our packet is a revised, it's our charter amendment, I think we discussed last time.
We need to do
which what it does is just keeps it the way it is, but it also adds back in that it could be filled by appointment.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we make that as a separate motion so we make sure that gets over?
I just wanted to suggest, you know, there is no reason at all to have any towns in North Carolina do not need to have a charter provision about this at all. There is a state statute that just spells out a process, and that 90-something percent of all towns in North Carolina are simply subject to what the state statute says, which is that you have an appointment until the next regularly scheduled municipal election.
So we can
now
do either.
Well, no, but actually we can't because we're sort of bound by what the charter says. But my point is really that, or my question is, do we really need any kind of provision in our charter, or couldn't we just ask to just have this section of our charter repealed and simply go with what the great majority of towns in North Carolina do? Or, Mr. Attorney, correct me if you think I'm misstating what the law is, but...
No, you're correct, I think, on both points. I think that our charter provision is, to my knowledge, unique. You'd have the choice of just asking to repeal what we and placed in there, or what I drafted was to have an alternative.
I don't know how we ever wound up with a charter provision at all, but I'm just at the point of questioning whether we need any charter provision at all.
There's a way
that this just works in North Carolina usually, and I don't see why we can't do it that way in the future.
I agree with Mark. I guess my one question is if under state law, Mike, if the vacancy were to happen in April, May, June, July, and if it were a seat that was not necessarily up that next November, would we still have the authority to say, well, let's just have the voters decide that one instead of making an appointment for 2 or 3 months?
No, I mean, I don't have the statute right here in front of me, but basically the statute says, establishes the deadline whereby if you have more than two, it's like more than 2 years and 90 days or something like that left in the term following the resignation, then the appointment, in either case, the appointment has to be made. That's the only choice that you have, is to make the appointment. And the only question is whether or not the person serves until the next election or serves the full remainder of the term. Something like if their term expires within 90 days of the next election, less than 90 days after the next election, then I think you serve the remainder of the term. And if it occurs before, the midterm election, then they're appointed until the midterm election, if that's making sense.
So that basically normally if somebody's appointed, they're appointed for 2 years or less, or at the absolute outside, 2 years and a couple
of
correct.
Months. That's correct. If you've got 3 years left in the appointment, or 3 years left in the term when the vacancy occurs, then the appointment only lasts until the next election.
Okay.
Midterm
right.
election.
Okay. And if it happened in May or June, the board might choose to not appoint someone for 3 or 4 months, and it could be part of the November election.
So really what she's trying to get at, I think the implication of the question really is under the statute that controls what most towns do, are they required to make an appointment at all, ever? That is say, isn't it possible to simply leave it, choose under certain circumstances to leave it vacant?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't think it's ever been tested, the issue of whether or not you could just basically say, I'm just not going to make that appointment. I mean, I think the statute does use the term may, and I guess the issue has been raised as to whether or not that means that there's a mandatory duty to make an appointment or not. I know there's some folks in the school of government feel that there is a mandatory duty, and the may language is really more referring to who can make the appointment as opposed to who has to make the appointment. But I don't know that it's ever been tested as if the council just said, well, heck, we don't need that person.
We're just not going to do it.
Not going to fill that seat. What implications that has, don't think that's arisen.
We kind of did it with Herrera's seat, if you recall. He resigned in like May or June or something, and
we just didn't fill it, but his seat was up
in November.
Right.
It was his new 4-year term was up in November, so it wasn't the halfway through.
I think you did fill it briefly.
Well, we
did after the – we waited until the election result happened.
Right.
And then
we let the election happen.
But the point is that we waited until –
And we appointed you
that's
for
actually,
a month.
But that's a fair enough point. We did actually fill it.
Yeah, for a month we did until the –
The question just sort of becomes like, so what? Somebody's going to go to court and get a writ of mandamus compel us to make a choice.
So this leaves us with the option of do we need to repeal so that opens up the option for us, or can we repeal at any point?
I'm just suggesting that maybe the absolute simplest thing is to just ask the legislature to eliminate that entire section of our of our charter, and we'll simply do this the way that
we want to take back.
Right.
We'll just do it the way that this just normally happens under North Carolina state law.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, okay.
So that's one, folks.
Somehow 200 and something municipalities in North Carolina get by with that rule.
It's more like 500, but that's...
And whatever the rule is, some 500 municipalities get by with it. Anyway, that's just my suggestion. So simple, and that way... If we decide that that's what we're going to do, we don't necessarily ever have to have
another discussion ever about it.
Unless you split 3-3 on the appointment again, which is what caused this to be drafted in the first place, that obviously you have a 7-person board with one resignation when you have 3-3 split.
That was a fun night, yeah.
I don't recall it being that much.
Well, but, and I don't recall it just being one night, as a matter of fact.
No.
But
that's you went on for several weeks.
But you know, part of the problem, even on that occasion, was honestly that there were members of the public who were confused by the fact that there seemed to be that the town charter seemed to say one thing and that the state law said something else. That was part of the, there was a public mm-hmm. partly it was a public perception mm-hmm. issue that it seemed as though maybe we were doing something that wasn't entirely consistent with state law. And my point is anyway that one of the other beauties of the solution I'm suggesting is that it certainly eliminates that confusion forever, or until somebody makes this mistake again mm-hmm. years from now.
Well, so in any event, that's one I want to be sure we talked about on Monday.
So why don't we put that up front first?
Well, why don't we just vote on?
Okay.
On that note, is there a motion that we just request the repeal of the charter provisions about that?
Just one question, I guess. And the urgency for doing it is because we'll have a legislative breakfast soon and convey it to them.
There's a deadline, I guess, for filing the bills that comes up before even have our election.
Yeah, I think it's end of February or 1st of March or something like that. You know, I mean, I'll point out in fairness, though, that it is common practice for people to introduce. Commonly happens that people introduce a local bill that is blank. That, in other words, so they get it filed by the deadline, even though the language is not filled in on what the bill says. So, I mean, that deadline is important in terms of establishing that we want a local bill. We don't absolutely have to know what that local bill will say, or what it is even rather. Obviously, it's up to the legislature what the local bill will say or whether it even passes, but the point being that we don't even have to have all that firm of a request by the deadline. But I guess my point is anyway that it just seems like there is a way that everybody else deals with this, and I just I'm at a loss to think of what the problem is with that.
Well, my point is more to, like, part of what our discussion was when we decided to go through with the special election was the idea that we would suss it out, see what it was like, and then have an informed decision on how to proceed thereafter. So if there was any chance for, changing this in time before it happens again.
I see what you're saying.
And having the benefit of the experience, then I would be in favor of that. If there isn't any time for that, then I understand.
I'd love to be able to tell you that there's no other way, but that's not really true. We could simply request a blank bill for now and say, you know, after March, when is the vote? 18th? 19th? Yeah. Whatever it is. That after the third week of March, that then we'll make a decision on exactly what our request is.
I would prefer that, just to be consistent.
I don't care.
We can run it past our legislators and see. I just don't want to, if we decide to do that, I don't want to miss the vote because of...
Right, I don't want either. I don't want to miss that either.
That's fine.
I don't care one way or the other, actually.
That's fine. Yeah. That's a reasonable request. All right, so we will request a blank bill on charter amendment for fulfilling the...
I'm not sure that... we can ask the our legislative representatives whether blank bills are okay, but even if they weren't, we could... The board could have introduced what I've drafted, which gives you the alternative, and then modify it. I mean, so
that's true. Absolutely. Yeah, that's fine.
Let's go with that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, so I'll take that as a motion for the charter amendment drafted by the attorney, with the understanding that may be further modified based on actual experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sammy moved. Is there a second?
Seconded
by Lydia. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I suppose. Okay.
Okay, and then my other one I'll just mention, and it's obvious to all, I think, but to ask our legislators to be sure to support all monies that come through to transit. There's been some talk that, you know, we'll lose some of the monies that come down to the local governments for transit operations, and that would be a bit discouraging in this year when we're tried to kick off our, you know, huge transit initiative that we all voted on and passed and so on.
All right.
Okay. I'd like to ask our legislators to support a ban on assault weapons and on high-capacity
magazines.
In the outside hope that they'll at least talk about it, and because I think it'd be a sin not to bring it up. And I'd like to add to that that I ask them to support the president's initiatives in gun control.
All right. I'm guessing we're mostly with you.
Yeah. Any of you against that? I'm saying.
Randy.
There's two or three items that we've discussed over the last few months, and I just want to know if these are items that we need to bring to our legislators. One had to do with the flexibility on the allocations with the Department of Water Quality, making a request. Didn't we, when we were working on the subcommittee, we talked about approaching the legislature with asking for local flexibility on the levels. And I'm wondering, I really think that if this is something that we're going to ask, no matter what we decide to do, you know, in terms of OWASA, to just open the door to have that discussion.
Let me suggest rather than, well, here would be my suggestion, would be rather than having a specific request on that point, that maybe we just make a point of having a conversation with our legislative delegation so they understand sort of where we're coming from on the whole issue. I mean, I don't think there's going to be I guarantee you that a local bill that had to do with water allocation from Jordan Lake would be going nowhere on its own. But
right.
But just to help them understand kind of what our values are and where we're coming from on the issue, I think would be probably where we need to head.
So, pardon? The administrative role.
Well, I'm not sure it is, but that's a whole other reason that conversation is going nowhere. But my point is also partly that, you know, they're not, whatever the policies are with respect to allocating water from various state reservoirs, they're not going to do it by local bill. It's going to be, you know, statewide legislation type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best we can hope to do is help ensure that our legislators kind of see what our values are and where we're coming from on it. That's my sense of it.
We're only signaling our position on that, or
we'll put it on the table for discussion.
Okay. That's one item. Then the other was our support for Asheville's water situation.
We've passed a resolution on that.
Yeah, I know, but is that something that we need to bring up?
I think that Kathy emailed it to them.
Okay.
Maybe not.
I think it's worthy. Especially, I guess, depending on whatever else may happen in the short term, that it's certainly worth mentioning to them.
Okay. And let me see. I've got a list here. The Gig U, is that something where we, in our discussion of Gig U, did we want to ask for more local control in some?
We couldn't even get that from the Democrats. Forget it. I mean,
maybe another awareness thing. I mean, I don't know.
I think it's fine.
I mean, these are things that we're trying to get our arms around, and I just feel like they need to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, again, we can put it on the agenda. I don't think I think it's almost pointless to have any kind of real specific legislative item we're requesting on that.
Okay.
But.
Many of the items, I agree with you on the North Carolina League of Municipalities. There were some I really agreed with. I'm glad the home rule was on there. I'm glad the fracking is on there. I want to make a special note that I'm really glad that they have the limit regulation on the land application of biosolids supporting Orange County and Alamance. But there were a couple of things that I just didn't understand and agree with? Do we need to test them out? Or
no, because okay. I think we ought to just leave their agenda alone. I mean, I don't think okay. we should adopt anything. That's my gut reaction, is I'm not inclined to adopt anything one way or the other on the league's agenda, because it's just so...
Okay.
It's I mean, so I don't even understand half of it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean...
Our manager will be going. Are we giving him direction to not support anything?
Well, there's a couple of things that were, that were odd that I was concerned about, and one of them had to do with the reclaimed water. Did you all have any thoughts on that? I mean, I was really kind of concerned that there's – let me find the –
Well, it's an example of an issue that I don't understand.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's something that our manager can kind of get more clarification on, because...
Or maybe you could feel comfortable voting on things we've had resolutions on, or...
Yeah, some of what's in there we've clearly staked ourselves out in the past as supporting, or in a few cases opposing.
Mm-hmm.
These
are not numbered, but this is on C5, the one I'm looking at, under Environment and Natural Resources. Support legislation to develop a holistic approach to water supply that offsets potable water supply demands and includes opportunities for increased water storage options, which I know we all agree with. And it says reclassification.
I mean, I guess it depends on what that means. If that means damming up the deep river and eliminating shiner habitat, then no. That's why I'm saying, I don't know what the hell they're talking about. I mean, I just,
I was thinking of that's why I kind cisterns.
I don't know, and that's why I kind of don't want to. I don't even want to mess with their agenda because I just don't even understand it, really.
I think, to me, on some of those, if we don't know, I'll just be neutral and not vote one way or the other. Because, I mean, it's hopefully they'll have an explanation of some of these things and, we'll have a better understanding. But some of them, that aren't relevant to us or we don't know enough about, I'll just not vote yay or nay.
Like, for example, the reclaimed water one.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's really complicated. Used as a way to privatize water in other states.
Right. There's some aspects of reclaimed water that are a good idea and some that are not. Right. And again, I don't know.
But reclassifying reclaimed water other than waste is, that's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, David,
That's why I'm saying I mean...
Mm-hmm. So
we could meet again tomorrow night and cover the whole thing.
One that really stands out to me.
But I'll miss you.
I won't be here, but y'all are welcome.
You're welcome.
One that I think is pertinent, as we've had these discussions on Rogers Road, is the one seeking legislation to authorize state bond to provide low-cost loans for local governments to upgrade on water and wastewater treatment systems. I mean, I don't know the... Probably the politics are not in our favor right now for that kind of thing, but it's one of those things that are significant in our current local politics that would help us greatly if we could have access to that kind of thing. And then lastly, I just encourage the manager to even speak out for the hydraulic fracturing one, which we've been leaders on, and is partly why it's even included in here. So. Just to make that point clear.
Yeah.
And then, of course, our ongoing, changing the Constitution, establish home rule.
We're in favor of that.
And David, if you could just come behind and underscore on the greenway, standards for greenway construction, so that greenways are not required to be built to the same standards as roads. Because one of the things we've been trying very hard to do in Carborough is have folks look at alternative surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
But this doesn't say that, but it would be great if
they
would actually get that in the language.
Okay. So in terms of what we're proposing to schedule for that we're going to either request from or discuss with our legislative delegation, we have a charter amendment, which we already voted on, Jordan Lake allocation. Brandy, you had another good idea. I forget already what it was.
I was talking about, was it Gig U? Oh, Asheville, Gig U.
Asheville.
Division of Water Quality.
Gig U.
Guns.
I said Jordan Lake. And then Guns.
Guns.
Protecting transit. So six items. So those will be, so is there a motion to have those be the six items on our agenda for discussion with the legislative delegation? It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passing unanimously. All right.
Can we delay the tree thing?
Can we delay the tree thing?
Is there something pressing in the creating a tree zoo?
I don't think there's anything pressing.
We'll try to get you on earlier next time.
I'm just
14
minutes. Oh, I'm sorry.
I agree.
Are you here for other? Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry.
We'll put you on early next time. All right. Item D6. So we're going to delay D7. The manager will pick a date to bring that back to us. Mm-hmm. Item by acclamation. Item D6, Safe Routes to School Program Report and Request for Implementation Committee Guidance. Briefly.
Yeah, what's wrong? My damn leaves and our meetings get longer.
Wow.
What was that?
No, it's just we make so infrequently in the fall.
That's
we're catching up.
Catching up.
No, really.
I know, but
we don't have Michelle here to rein us in.
Right.
I know, she's out doing yoga with
adopting elephants.
I bet she's teaching yoga to elephants. She
if it could be done, she could
mm-hmm.
do it.
He did bring his own unique energy.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Jeff. Save us
from ourselves.
Go ahead, Jeff.
That's funny.
Yet another benefit of Safe Routes to School, changing the discussion topic.
That's right.
This is you have the full report in your agenda packet, and it outlines some of the many accomplishments we've been able to make over the past 3 years, including with the help especially of NCDOT grants that we were fortunate to receive. For these two schools, we created an action plan. We received an infrastructure grant to build a sidewalk on Elm Street and do encouragement activities at Carborough Elementary so that kids could walk to school and say Carborough Elementary walks to school on their sign. So we all know about the many benefits of safe routes to school, health, physical activity, alertness in class, of course, and then better air quality, and less congestion, and potentially less cost for providing transportation services for students. The board has set the precedent by adopting the Safe Routes to School Action Plan in May of 2012. This is a landmark event for the program, and not many municipalities around the country have adopted Safe Routes to School Action Plan, so it's really a pioneering effort by the board. The advisory boards all recommended it, and it was also endorsed by the Board of Education as well. So it has widespread support, which is a really good foundation to have for your program. And by the way, I do have some copies available for browsing in the planning department. This is a really great plan that was put together with all of the action plan team and the two consulting firms, Green Transportation Solutions and Greenways Incorporated, who worked on this. So it's a really great plan. It's available in hard copy, on CD, and on the website. So.
Wow.
So here's the Elm Street sidewalk. Before, kids had to walk next to traffic, and now you can see it built afterwards. This was a Carborough Public Works project, and unlike the most before after, you try and bias the before and after. We have snow in the after picture, but so we don't have rainbows and rabbits running around and everything like that. But
afterwards, there was an empty sidewalk.
Yeah, yeah. It's not the best picture, but it shows you that it's there, and it's a very good sidewalk. We've done a lot of walking and cycling encouragement at Carborough Elementary. So this was fall 2010, walk and bike to school day. And there were walking school buses. which have groups of kids with parents walking to school from even as far as Spring Valley and beyond, and they all had their signs, "We walk to school." The parents got free open-eye coffee when they got there, so everybody was happy. We had a bike safety rodeo in March of 2011, kids learning hand signals. Spring 2011, walk and bike to school, we had 132 kids either walking or biking to Carborough Elementary that day, including 59 cyclists, which was enough to completely fill up the three bike racks that that were there, including this one, which was donated by a parent after learning about the bike parking shortage at the bike safety rodeo. So that was great. And then Carborough Elementary had some photos up on their website. 132 students walked or biked to school.
Wow.
Spoken Revolutions, the amazing East Chapel Hill High School cycling team. They've now cycled from Alabama to Canada and from Nebraska to the West Coast. And on this week, they came and every morning did, on very short notice, gave presentations on bike safety and bike repair to the kids in morning assembly. So they were great. Then in fall 2011, walk or bike to school day, I said in previously for spring 2011, we had 132 kids walking or biking total. This time we had 132 walkers alone and another 40-some cyclists. So about a third of the enrollment used active transportation to get to school, which is really incredible. And for kids who live too far away to walk, they were able to park at Town Hall and walk the rest of the way so everybody could participate. And then we also were able to help support the first Kidical Mass in North Carolina. And this was organized a lot by the Recyclery with support from the Carborough Bicycle Coalition and other, and of course, town departments. So what's the impact of the program? Well, these are counts that we took from 2011. And you can see that in January, this is somewhat weather dependent, but in January, you have 5% of kids walking and less than 1% of kids biking. But after the bike safety rodeo, you start to see the numbers rise. And here you see spring 2011, you had 25% of all kids walking or biking. And then fall 2011, you had 33% of all kids walking or biking. This graph is kind of complicated, but you can see here's the national walk average, and nationally about 13 to 16% of kids walk to school and about 2% of kids bike to school. Each of these are individual student tallies at Carborough Elementary. So you can see that they have been short of the national walk average, but you can see that when the encouragement grant period started, we had some higher peaks in walking, and we had a noticeable increase in cycling to school. So that's another impact. And our latest counts after the Elm Street sidewalk were built showed pretty high levels of walking and cycling. So that's an encouraging sign. And this is McDougal. We have less counts for them, but they are just about at the walk average, maybe a little bit low, but above here, and they are well over the bike average. So McDougal is a real champion for cycling. Through our evaluation, we're able to tell from parents, why do you let your kid walk or bike to school? And parents say, well, the main reasons are low traffic along the route, low traffic speed along the route. There's good intersection crossing safety. There's presence of sidewalks and pathways. And there's a short distance to school. So those are the top five reasons why parents let their kids walk to school. And then we also asked, well, for parents who don't let their kids walk or bike to school, why don't you? And similar factors just flipped. Well, my kid lives too far away. There's no presence of sidewalks or paths. There's intersections or crossings are unsafe. There's not enough crossing guards, and there's a high amount of traffic. And we also get a number of parent comments in our surveys, which are really helpful. A crossing guard in Greensboro near Bowen Forest, Weathervane, or Robert Hunt would make a big difference. We need more bike racks at McDougal. Our concern has been with walking our daughter's safety and walking by herself. We want a group of friends to walk with her. All very understandable and diverse reasons and diverse comments from parents. So this is really helpful engaging what we need to work on. So in attachment A2 of your packet, there's a resolution that follows up on the previous resolution that the board made establishing an implementation committee. So this resolution isn't the actual establishment of the committee, but it allows the board to provide feedback on the makeup of the committee, the mission, and so forth. And then I just wanted to note if you do a speed round of other projects that aren't Safe Routes to School, they don't have that label specifically, but they are really helping kids to have better and safer and more convenient options for walking to school. The Pine Street sidewalk was completed, another public works project. The Hillsborough James curb extension is another project that we've doing temporary measure, and now we've received a allocation from NCDOT to make it permanent this coming summer. Main Street Road Diet was another action plan priority. Jones Ferry Road Diet will extend the sidewalk on the north side of Jones Ferry and calm traffic. That will be completed this year. And then even more projects, the Wilson Park multi-use path completed, Homestead Chapel Hill multi-use path, Morgan Creek Greenway. These are, of course, in the vicinity of other schools, which aren't Carborough or McDougal, but they do help improve options for walking and cycling for those kids. Police Department's pedestrian safety campaign has been extremely helpful. The Watch for Me NC education campaign, and, of course, other activities and programs. So, this program is very strong, and there's a lot of people to thank for it, and these are some of the contributors. And you can't do it without having a collaboration amongst all these agencies. So, with this collaboration that we have, and with the activities that we've done over the past 3 years, I think Carborough has one of the strongest Safe Routes to School just collective efforts in the state, and it's something that we hope can continue too, even though our NCDOT grants have been completed. So with that, I'll conclude the presentation.
I have a question.
Randy, and then Lydia.
Chair, how do you think the Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools redistricting is going to affect our efforts to, at Carborough and at McDougal?
I think it'll have some effect. Haven't studied so closely that I will know exactly what the interaction between the Safe Routes to School program and the redistricting will be. I think obviously where it comes into play is that if a new sidewalk is built and an area becomes a walk zone, then that area cannot be redistricted to another school. I can't comment on the details of the current redistricting.
I would really like, if possible, for you, since the redistricting was only voted on this last week, if at least during, this next year you keep an eye on how it impacts, because this again is another example to me of how there really is a lack of, communication in terms of the school district and the municipalities in terms of making a concerted effort. It crystallizes for me in terms of Frank Porter Graham now being a magnet school that totally takes it, you know, off the out of the picture in terms of being a real walk zone school that affects children who live in Carrboro. And so I wonder, you know, on one hand that, you know, the school district supports safe routes to school, and on the other hand, they're going to be busing over 1,000 children. So I would really just like to see how much it affects Carrboro as it gets launched this next year. If that's okay, the rest of the board.
Lydia, and then
Jeff, thanks for the report. It's great. I always like to see these statistics, and it's a nice overview and represents a lot of hard work. I just want to comment, as I always do, on your suggestion here that the town may wish to dialogue with Morris Grove Elementary to determine whether and how the program can support the improvement of active travel options for its students. And, you know, I think I've mentioned this before, that there are a lot of kids that walk and bike up through that Twin Creeks Greenway already. And I think even with just identifying a day in the fall or spring when for education, because I know even though a lot of our neighbors do use it, I know a lot of them have no idea that it's there or how to use it. And that one graph that you had that described a lot of the reasons why people don't walk or bike to school, you know, like traffic and safety, and there's, you know, it's the safest.
And even distance, it's about the perception of those things, not the actuality.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that far, and the only safety I can think of is it's so beautiful and isolated, but when a lot of people are out there, you don't feel isolated, but there's not the intersections or crossings that are that dangerous. Like, Hickman Farms already has a lot of their own bike lanes and networks, and the other ones that feed into that are fairly safe. So I'd like to just see maybe at a minimum some type of a walk and bike to school day in the fall or spring, sooner or later.
That's a good point.
Yeah, Sammy. And related to that point, in trying to match perceptions to reality, and of course the advisory group that's going to push this forward is probably going to have all kinds of ideas. But one idea is to have a map showing kind of like where the crosswalks are that are safe and what the speed zones are. And if we have numbers for what the actual speed zones are, even better, as opposed to what the speed limits are. But I don't know, if we had a map like that, it would also help us inform us as to where we could improve. So there was one comment on from the Homestead to Carver Elementary, like if we had a map showing how to get to Carver Elementary and then identify kind of the danger zones on that map, that could inform where we should be prioritizing our sidewalks. Or from the Chapel Hill side of the other side of IT's apartments, that's an ongoing trouble spot that we already know about. But, you know, similar opportunities like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of the high-density apartments have cross, you know, informal walkways. To identify those on a map and be able to share that through the school system might encourage even more walking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And some of that is in the action plan that the consultants did. There's some good maps in Chapter 2, but that can certainly be, you know, looked at again and refined as needed.
And to figure out how to disseminate that outside of that plan with the schools. Thanks. Looks really good.
I just want to add, thanks to everybody who participated in helping make this happen, Jeff especially, but also I know a lot of people volunteered, a lot of staff from other local governments, and also plenty of parents at McDougal and at Carrboro Elementary. One thing I took note of that I thought was a pretty cool idea, and I think that is worthy of being pursued is the notion of there being some opportunity for student participation in the committee. And so I'd like y'all to look into that further. I can think of one young lady who I think almost certainly must be in either in fifth grade at Carrboro Elementary or in sixth grade at
McDougall, who came and petitioned this board a year or two ago. Bremer, I can't remember.
Alia. She'd be good on this board. We should appoint her.
Yeah, we should. We can't make an appointment. Yeah. But seriously, a young lady who like really is a remarkably mature and civic minded person. Somebody anyway, doesn't have to be her, but anyway, the point is that I think there probably is somebody out there who would be a particularly good candidate for representing the kind of student perspective, and I think that's worth pursuing. So I hope you will continue on that path. And then the other thing I just wanted to say is, I guess I haven't looked either at what the new walk zone, particularly for Carver Elementary, is. But assuming that it hasn't changed that, or that the district hasn't changed that much, that Main Street road diet is so much more, my perception anyway, so much more important than any sidewalk we could build. Mm-hmm. You know, that Main Street is such a huge barrier to a lot of families who might otherwise participate and might otherwise walk to Carver Elementary, and that that should be, you know, the number one priority, because it's not that much money, and if we can get permission to do it, it'll make a huge impact on the walkability of Carver Elementary. Yeah. And then tangential but kind of similar. I believe at one time, I love where we've gotten so far with the multi-use path at Wilson Park is really coming together nicely, and it looks looking really good. We're getting close to being done with that. I think we're going to have some kind of groundbreaking probably in early March or something like that over there. I'm really looking forward to that. Thank you, Public Works. In connection with that, one of the things we had talked about at one time was talking to DOT about a pedestrian-activated crosswalk light at the driveway to Estes Park Apartments. Mm-hmm. And this, I don't necessarily expect the kids are going to walk to school along that route, but by using such a light. But is that something that's under discussion or still under consideration with DOT? Is it still a possibility or?
Yeah, if you recall, we did report this to the Greenways Commission when the Wilson Park design was going on. There was an interest in getting a rapid flash beacon, so a rapid flashing module mounted underneath the diamond crosswalk sign to make that more visible, and that idea concept was presented to NCDOT, but it is kind of an innovative treatment. There's only a few in North Carolina, and the NCDOT did not approve of that. They did say that the town could try a hawk signal or the pedestrian activated stoplight, basically, but those are really expensive and beyond our budget. So that's kind of the context,
I think it's encouraging that they're even willing to consider that possibility, and maybe we already talked about how there's not enough STPDA money for all the things that we might want to do, but put that into the hopper maybe in terms of thinking about future STPDA projects. But, you know, we've built or just about finished building a really beautiful path that creates a really nice connection to not only the Wilson Park but to the rest of our community from Estes Park. And, you know, having the pedestrian-activated light there would make that path much, much more meaningful. And, anyway, I just hope we'll stay on that and pursue that. I don't think we can expect to do it without federal help, but...
Well, we also talked about having the solar assisted light. Is that what you were just referring to?
The flashers.
Yeah, but the solar.
But solar powered.
Those are both those flasher modules and also the edgelet, the cross edgelet LED edgelet crosswalk signs like you have on MLK.
Yeah.
and on Franklin. Both of those are solar powered.
Yeah, those are the. That's what I was asking at Greenway about, because I think that that would work, and that's less expensive, isn't it, than the other. And the other point that I brought up at Greenway had to do with getting a sign on William Street directing folks to the park, to the multi-use path, because William Street doesn't have that right now.
Mm.
So if we could get a sign
That's a good point.
Awesome.
You know,
just to point out the connection, yeah.
A pedestrian crosswalk without a stoplight scares me. I think it's setting people up. Every time I go down MLK Boulevard, which isn't that often, I think, my God, somebody's plowing down here at 60 miles an hour, and the pedestrians feel safe to cross because there's a flashing pedestrian thing in the middle.
I'm afraid to yield to them because I'm afraid somebody's going to plow into the
back of me. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
No, and Jackie, to your point, and I agree, and I don't think it's a hawk signal, Jeff, but like in Durham on Cornwallis Road where the ATT crosses over, there's a couple of spots there where it's a, you know, the pedestrian pushes it, and then there's a light that makes the car stop. I mean, it's not just that.
It's a true stoplight.
We need some SDBDA funding or something to make that happen.
But it's right on
the railroad doesn't even have that.
Yeah, but anything else, I think you're setting people up. It's like having outdoor cats and a bird feeder. You know?
Well, we've got that on North Greensboro, too. You know, we know.
Jeff, I know the high schools aren't included in the Safe Route to School funding, but the question of to what extent could we designate a Safe Route to School zone around a high school with the Smith Level Road coming in and all the facilities for bikes and pedestrians, and I think even leading up to the high school, to know like the degree to which we're getting close to it, even without funding, and then to be able to designate that as a Safe Route to School. Do we have a sense of that? Or is that been looked at?
It has been looked at. I remember various communications with, I think, the police department and others about the question of, you know, expanding the school zones on Smith Level and so forth. I'd have to kind of look back at those and report back on what exactly those conversations were.
That'd be fine. Maybe you hit this, and hopefully we can be done, but so this closes out the grant or grants that we've had thus far in connection with Carborough and McDougall. Is it too much to hope for to think of ever going back into the same program and saying, well, we want to now apply to do the same thing with Morris Grove, for example? Is that
it's absolutely legitimate to seek more funding. There is still some Safe Routes federal funding under the previous transportation bill that may be made available by NCDOT. In addition, each division gets a separate pot of Safe Routes funding, which I should mention, one of the projects that funded is the small section of sidewalk on Colberth Road that was managed by the town of Chapel Hill that will complete the sidewalk on the south side of the road after the Smith Level is done. So there's that pot of funding. And then you know, the new transportation bill still allows for Safe Routes programs to be funded by its new bike and ped program called Transportation Alternatives. So there's that pot of funding, too. It remains to be seen what exactly NCDOT will do with that pot of funding, but that's available. I think that that'll be available in the future. I did hear an anecdote that there is some kind of continued commitment by NCDOT to their Safe Routes to School program. So that's an encouraging sign. So it's absolutely hopeful to keep an eye on those future.
I think our new Secretary of Transportation is big on neighborhood schools, from what I understand. But anyway, if that opportunity presents itself for us to pursue that with Morris Grove, then let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Anyway.
And one more thing, if I could make it real quick. Trish mentioned before about the CMAQ allocation for extending Twin Creek southward. There is actually a small bit of funding in there for implementation of encouragement activities at Morris Grove. As Trish mentioned, that allocation needs a local match, but that's a non-Safe Routes to School little pot of funding that can be applied to exactly, you know, the encouragement at Morris Grove. So.
Great. All right.
Jeff. Thank you.
Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
For the love of God, tell me there's a motion
move
to adjourn.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passing unanimously. Thanks very much.